As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
And tame again.
Crank up the music! Charge your glass! This nation is going to dance all night!
The complex concept of World Cup dark horsery. Why do we care about the last chance for other countries' golden generations? Optimum BST kickoff times. The vital importance of having great goalkeeper and referee kits above all else. The World Feed commentary legends. Player X, who plays his football in country Y for the Z-named club. And trawling back through the history books for the last memorable World Cup final wonder goal. Brought to your ears by The Athletic. This is Football Clichés and the perfect World Cup. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 207 of Football Clichés. I'm Adam Hurry and with me to pick this perfect World Cup is first of all James Moore. How's it going?
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Adam.
Before we get stuck into World Cup matters, I haven't got the energy to work this out for myself. I wonder if you can help me. Why on earth is today's featured article on Wikipedia, on the very front page of Wikipedia, the 1963-64 Gillingham FC season?
I mean, well, you tell me. You must have clicked on it if you've seen that, surely.
Yeah, but
that is clickbait if ever I've seen it.
I'm none the wiser. Mark J. Wallace enlightens me slightly about how the process of how this happens. He says, I generally want to know how this got through. I edit Wikipedia for football history purposes, for my sins, and you generally need to petition for it and have it approved by mods like planning permission for a stadium. So someone has got this through, James. I want to know.
Amazing. That's amazing.
Nothing particularly spectacular happened in that season either. So it's not like it was like, I don't know, nothing.
Are there any kind of big names that were playing for them as kids or whatever? There's no one in the squad that's kind of, you know, future World Cup winners or European Cup winners or whatever.
Don't think so. I think they won their first 13 games or something. Or they were unbeaten in their first 13 games, which is a Football League record, or was a Football League record. Not enough. I don't know what it's doing on the front page. It should be a random entry, if anything, but not the featured article. Alongside you for this selection process is the venerable Jack Pitbrook. How's it going?
Good, thanks.
Are you happy with what we're trying to achieve here? Because I think we've done the perfect Euros before, and it fell flat a bit in my eyes. But the World Cup has far more historical, cultural oomph behind it. I think this is a worthwhile exercise.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. World Cups are better than Euros. Euros are good, but World Cups are better. And I was going to say they're rarer. They're not. They're exactly as rare as Euros. but yeah, you know what I mean. This will be fun.
On a kind of semi-serious note, James, I mean, I know Qatar 2022 has gone from a joke to a farce to a scandal to a tragedy and a disgrace, all while being a massive inconvenience and just simply a non-canon World Cup in many people's eyes. I don't want to be trying to be sort of facetious about any of that. This is a kind of separate exercise. I'm trying to embrace the concept of the World Cup in its purest
most closely approximated form. It is, you know, whether we like it or not, it's World Cup season. I am not afflicted by World Cup fever, and yet I still feel like I must go through the motions of it.
Yeah, I don't think there's any danger of us including human rights abuses in the perfect World Cup, is there?
I would be stunned if any element of Qatar 2022. But tell you what, if we do manage to get a tiny element of Qatar 2022 into this episode, it will be, in its weird kind of way, something of a triumph. Let's see if that ever happens over the next hour or so. Right, time to kick off our perfect World Cup. I want to read out this smorgasbord of suggestions from Alex and Sean from No Score Draws. James, they say a perfect World Cup needs an aesthetically perfect mix of kits. A 2022 World Cup has an unacceptable preponderance of teams playing in red shirts. 13 teams plus Croatia in red and white, which is simply too many. A better mix is needed to fully imprint the visuals of a World Cup on the memory, covering the full gamut of colours, stripes and sashes. So I propose a limit of 10 teams in red, plus the following. Buys for the Netherlands and Cote d'Ivoire to ensure two teams in orange. Two comparable places allocated to the reliably well-turned out pair of Peru and Paraguay. Four teams in yellow, four teams in green. Brazil, Sweden, Australia, Colombia, Cameroon, Mexico, Ireland, Nigeria will be entirely acceptable. Light and dark blues covered. One colour goalkeeper shirts to be banned. Fairly comprehensive aesthetic breakdown here.
No, but I don't think you can argue with any of that. That all makes perfect sense to me. That's all absolutely right. So are we banning nations with red shirts after a certain point, or are we going to make them change?
I don't know, I can't get my head around it, to be honest, but I think overall I kind of agree with the spirit.
Yeah, you definitely need the mix. I mean, Peru in the last World Cup, obviously their first World Cup for quite a long time, it's so good to see that kit at a World Cup. It just makes such a difference when you see that. And Australia, when Australia started qualifying, it just feels good to see like a recognisable kit in the context of a World Cup when you haven't actually seen that in the flesh before. It's really nice.
Yeah, seeing that Peru kit in the last World Cup, mate, it's, I think for a lot of fans, it was the moment you could finally kind of identify with your dad going on about Kubiast forever.
I mean, I'm glad you're on board with this, Jack, because it does feel like a basic preoccupation, World Cup kits. I mean, I'm saying it with disdain, as if I haven't been preoccupied by it over the last 30 years or so of my life. But it's part of the aesthetic appeal of a World Cup. You know, and kits are important for a reason, but at World Cups they take on an extra significance because they're representing a country, and in some respects representing a country's history at the World Cup. So, like Peru, the whole thing is very important.
Yeah, I think they are important. It's kind of fun to have opinions about them. I don't really remember that. How many do you actually remember from the last 10 years or 20 years that you could say, that was really good, that one? Nigeria last year is a good example. Nigeria 2018 was obviously hugely popular. Beyond that, how many other jump out? Cameroon being denied the right to go sleeveless in 2002.
Yeah.
That was a good little story.
Stitch on their silly little sort of black sleeves.
Mexico looked quite good this time. But beyond that, James, do you have any favourites? I mean,
everyone was going mad about the England shirt in 2010. Like a very sort of simplistic white. I think it might have been the last Umbro one, maybe. But looking back on it now, I don't think it's really kind of stood the test of time. Possibly because England was so bad at that
time. That's one thing we can safely say, it's never going to go retro.
And I mean, this is the last time we'll say this on this podcast, but you're obviously swayed by like your first World Cup and your childhood memories of watching World Cup.
That's fine.
So more or less for me, 94 was the first one I kind of dipped into. 98 was the first one I was properly, fully immersed in. And more or less every kit at that World Cup, the France kit at that World Cup is amazing. That Mexico kit with the kind of Aztec design on it is really, really good. Quite like that England kit. I think Denmark might have had a good kit, not quite 86 levels, but I think pretty smart. The one thing I would say I dislike, and I don't want to get into a big rant about templates because that's incredibly boring and incredibly Twitter.
Yeah.
But if you look back at the kits from 2006, there are, I would say, probably at least 15 Adidas kits that are more or less exactly the same, and they look shit.
Right.
The template is so bad. If you remember, there's like a kind of, not a sash, but kind of a line that comes down from the collar and then suddenly takes like a left turn across the chest and then down. Right. There's stripes everywhere. There's just too much going on. Not a good look for me.
I think the stripes often ruin it, actually. Like, Argentina is a kit with such a distinctive look by itself that the addition of the stripes in 2006 actually kind of killed the clarity and purity of the design.
Okay. Yeah, various kit manufacturers in bad moments over the course of the history of the World Cup. Let's take this relatively chronologically. Jack, what kind of things would you want / expect to see in the lead-up to a World Cup?
I think the most important thing for me, and this is going to sound very Anglo-centric, is a big, silly argument about the location and funness of the England training camp. Which seems to operate on a kind of alternates between, you know, the very, very kind of last days of Rome of with Baden-Baden 2006. You see the very kind of military training camp of Royal Bafokeng Complex in Rustenburg in 2010. Yeah. Then kind of somewhere in the middle for 2014 outside, I couldn't pin down the name of it. I think it was Urca, like a military base in 2014, back to like the sort of remote but laid back compromise of Reppenau in 2018. And every time England's failures are blamed on the camp at the last World Cup being either too fun or not fun enough. So all you have to do is just crank that big lever from fun to not fun to get the correct results next time.
So it's like a proper Goldilocks situation, James, with England's camps, isn't it? It's a bit like our attitude towards punditry on TV. Nobody really knows what they want from an England camp, do they?
It feels incredibly tomato ketchup to me. That's what it is, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. It's a representation of precisely the same thing. That's exactly it.
Excellent. Okay, so England, who knows what they'll get up to or not get up to in Qatar in their camp this time. Jack, what about dark horses chat?
Yeah, so every World Cup, I think every fan at every World Cup needs a dark horse.
Yeah.
But I was thinking, what is a successful dark horse shout? Because you would look like, imagine how ridiculous you would look if you said, my dark horse is Argentina or Holland or Germany. Mm-hmm. It can't be a team that's won it before, even come close to winning it before.
Really?
I don't think so. You can't have Brazil as a dark horse. Can you have
Uruguay could be a dark horse. I mean, how far back are you allowed to go?
Might be the one team who've won it before who could be a dark horse.
Okay, good.
But
that's
equally,
fine.
You couldn't have like a really, really niche team who had no chance of winning at all. Like, I don't think you could have South Korea as a dark horse.
This is important. I think this is important. This is more important than us discussing sort of failed dark horses of the past. I think it's good to set these parameters, but you're right. It can't be a real hipster's choice, can it?
No, it could. You can't really have Senegal as dark horses, I don't think. So I think I think dark horses are almost always European, and almost always they haven't won it before. So I think the traditional dark horse trio are Turkey, Croatia, and Serbia.
They create great players as well, so they've got that sprinkling of talent that is irresistible.
That needs to be quite businesslike, I think. I mean, Turkey at the last Euros may be the exception to this, but I think they shouldn't be a fun team. They shouldn't be more functional.
No, I agree with you. They shouldn't be a
really?
Fun team.
More often than not, I'd say it's like a team with... It's more often than not going to be a team with incredibly good defence and like one amazing attacking player.
Poland have ever been a dark horse with Lewandowski? Probably not.
Possibly
but you
not.
Know who I... But I think this year's dark horse fits into these parameters precisely, and that's Denmark.
Yeah, I can see that.
They're going to win their group.
I'm surprised, James.
They're
going to
be the dark horse.
I'm surprised, James, that you think it's a pragmatic thing, dark horsery, because to me, off the top of my head, I feel like it's the international equivalent of someone saying, Sarri's Napoli, don't sleep on them, that sort of thing. It's like, I mean, it's just like, it's like a one intellectual step below hipsterdom. It's like, everybody knows about this team, but trust me, I've looked into them really hard and they're going to tear it up at the World Cup, right under your noses.
To get me thinking, do you think Croatia in 2018 is that the most successful genuine dark horse run in World Cup history? A rare example of a dark horse who actually came close to winning it.
Yeah, well, Turkey reached the semis, didn't they, in 2002?
But were Turkey dark horses? I don't think they were. No one was talking
2002?
About 2002?
No, because Galatasaray was strong.
It's not just being an outsider, it's being tipped before the tournament. And I don't think anyone was talking about Turkey before that tournament, surely.
To be a dark horse, do you actually have to be tipped to win it? No.
I think you have to be talked about before the tournament.
You have to be tipped to be in the conversation.
It's a very flimsy term, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Talked about before the tournament.
Yeah,
maybe I'm wrong, but I don't really remember that being the case.
Interesting. On a related note, I like this from Colin Weir, Jack, who says, this will be about the fifth World Cup Euros in a row where it's been the last chance for this Belgian side's golden generation. I think if you take that theme as a wider thing, I quite like the idea of this last chance for country X's golden generation, because it almost like we've all got a vested interest to share, like we're all kind of stakeholders in the success of this country we have no connection with. It's like, yeah, finally, I want to see them over the line.
Yeah, no, I think that is definitely true. And I'm sure that is the case. Like, it would probably... I bet people would have started saying that when they lost to Wales in 2016, the Hal Robson-Kanu game. And yeah, I think one of the things I like about international football is if there's not... You don't want to see too much turnover of players. You want to see... It's just like the same, like... It's always the same Swiss team You know, it's not Kelson Fernandez anymore, but I've forgot the names now. Rodriguez at left back, Xhaka. Yeah.
The centre forward who never scores. Who's that centre forward?
Harris Seferovic.
Seferovic, that's it, yeah.
Not a day goes by without Jack Pibrick saying the name Harris Seferovic at me.
Jadon
Shaqiri.
I feel like in my head you've got the kind of Euro 96 Chapuisat team. And then the only other era in Swiss football since 1996 is this one. And it's been Rodriguez, Xhaka, Shaqiri, Briel Embolo and the lads for the last like 30 years.
But they've not got Petkovic now, have they? The manager. The suave manager is gone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's not going to be the same. He had a face like a sort of Roman emperor, didn't he?
Yeah, he really did.
Yeah.
He really did.
Roman emperor turned car salesman, I'd say.
Okay, yeah, nice. The interesting thing about the sort of prolonged golden generation chat, James, is that it flies in the face of the people who claim that we should be having a World Cup every 2 years to give these players a chance to appear at a World Cup more, to see these big talents on the stage. As long as they stay fit, you know, injuries are part of football. That's just tough. As long as you stay fit, you can do a Switzerland and appear at 3 or 4 World Cups without apparently aging at all. That's your lot. That's enough. You don't need it any more than 4 World Cups. 4 World Cups is shitloads.
So you're saying like Cafu is taking the piss. Cafu went to 5, didn't he? Yeah. You're saying he's taking the piss by that.
Well, I know.
Maybe there should be a limit on how many
entitled
you can play.
To be there. I'm just saying I'm not going to lament the fact that he didn't get to 5.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I see what you mean. I mean, yeah, that does seem, if you think about that period of time, that does seem excessive. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I want to get onto some technical matters now, Jack. Simply want you to pick the dream format for your perfect World Cup. How complicated do you want to go? Do you want best runners up? Do you want best third place teams? I mean, how straightforward do you want it to be?
Very straightforward.
Good.
I think the kind of it makes me very angry that football authorities have such a good thing in terms of a simple, clean, parallel group system, and they've now decided, oh no, let's ruin it by chucking in third place teams. If you come third and fourth place in a group before, you do not deserve to go through to the next round. Like, that's so obvious. Like, that's really obviously borne out by domestic European knockout, by European knockout football, by Euros and the World Cups. So it makes me, I believe, what, this is going to be the last World Cup with the 32 with that's the right. 8 groups of 4 format,
yeah.
Which sucks. That really sucks. And it's, yeah, I mean, I know why they're doing it, because they want more money, but it's rubbish. It is rubbish.
And so that will give way, James, to the 2026 World Cup in Canada,
yeah.
USA and Mexico, which I believe will be safely described as sprawling.
Yeah, it definitely will.
Yeah.
I would counter Jack's point, though, by saying, if you think back to 2002 again, that tournament was incredibly entertaining in the group stage when most of the top sides got knocked out. But by the time you got to the knockout stages, a lot of quite bad games between less good teams. And it wasn't amazing to watch. And actually, I think if some of those third place teams do sneak through, it didn't happen in that tournament, but if France had been third or whatever else.
That's just the luck of the draw, though. That's just incidental, isn't it?
You need the best teams in the knockout stages. And if you have to gerrymander it a little bit, so be it.
You're going to get some shit munches third place teams through.
You're always going to get shit munches, whatever you do.
That's completely against the spirit of a competition. If you just want the good teams in, then you should just give them by straight through to the knockout rounds.
It's International Super League.
The argument that I'm making isn't like an instrumental argument about how to create a good last 16. It's a moral argument about whether or not you deserve to go through. If you come third out of 4, you do not deserve to go through morally.
Yeah, I agree. Cut Jack Pitbrook open and he bleeds 32 teams, 8 groups of 4, last 16, quarters, semis, final, done.
16 teams, 4 groups of 4 in the Euros. But in a World Cup context, I bleed 32 teams, 8
good,
groups of 4.
Good.
How would you feel about 64 teams at the World Cup? Would you rather have 64 teams in the World Cup than whatever it's going to be?
Yes, but not if all 64 teams flew to the final country. Only if the 64 teams...
come on.
You had 64 teams in a straight knockout before flying onto the host nation.
Oh, fucking hell.
This is rubbish.
Old Euros. We're not doing that.
Yeah,
Jack, you've lost.
This.
What a shame. What a shame. An addendum to this, James. In my perfect World Cup, there wouldn't be a third or fourth place playoff. Not for the usual reasons, which we all agree on, it's a pointless game. Nobody wants to be there. But you got knocked out. Your tournament's over. So whilst it has a natural interest level, the third and fourth place playoff, nobody wants to watch it. They've probably stuck it on ITV4, whatever. It should have the official status of like a community shield. Like, it shouldn't be considered a competitive game. You're out of the tournament. Go home.
I mean, I didn't watch it in 2018. Adam, did you watch it?
I went to
Belgium.
That's why I didn't ask you, Jack. I just can't think, like, why would you... I surely no players want to play in that. It's just horrible. It's torture.
It was rubbish. It was like both England-Belgium games at the last World Cup were a bit of a farce. Like Kaliningrad in the group stage because they made all those changes, and then the third, fourth place playoff in St. Petersburg because it was a third, fourth place playoff. And in both times, like you could tell that both those games were played at walking pace and were just rubbish games. It felt like a pretty pointless exercise.
I agree. Another example of a third and fourth place playoff match that just bears no resemblance to the rest of the tournament narrative, which is England versus Italy at Italia 90. Now, everyone remembers, of course, the high emotions of England's penalty shootout defeat against Germany. Tears, all sorts. And then you see a picture of them all in the third, fourth place playoff, including Stuart Pearce, all doing a Mexican wave really gleefully on the touchline during the match of the third and fourth place playoff. It's just like, it's not part of the experience. It should be buried, should be all erased from memory. It didn't happen. So that's it. So that's our format. Let's have some various other observations from our listeners. James Reese Jones writes in and says, match scheduling is vital for a perfect World Cup. Brazil 2014 fell at 5 p.m, 8 p.m, and 11 p.m. UK time. That was perfect. Far too many games in the working day this year, and the novelty of early morning starts, a la Japan Korea, quickly wears off for actually enjoying the football. How do you feel about this? What's your sweet spot as a punter?
Well, it's difficult for us to say because, like, in our job, we get to watch the football in the daytime, so we're kind of quite privileged.
Not as funny as you think.
I like an earlier game. I think there's a novelty to having like a league football on in the daytime in the week.
How early?
I'm up for... I mean, I don't think this has ever happened. 3 o'clock on like a sort of weekday feels like quite a good...
That's fine. Yeah, that's doable.
Maybe you go 2:57 or whatever. 2:58. That feels nice.
Good to have... Jack, I would say we can quibble about an hour here or there, but I think it's good to have some group stage matches kicking off during office hours in the UK to test various offices' willingness to show football in the office. Because I think that's the true test of an office atmosphere, of how important someone's job is whether you're allowed to watch football on the side of the office.
Absolutely. Or, I don't know if they still have this in schools now, but wheeling the TV in.
All right, Peter Kay. Drinking your fucking Panda Pops, watching the World Cup.
England-Tunisia, 1998?
With his remote control watch.
Yeah, England-Nigeria. I think as well.
Chris Packett flies across the front of the
beach. Yeah. But I've got no idea what modern glassmen are like, Adam, so I don't know if wheeling the TV in is still a
thing. Oh, I hope so.
During this World Cup, and obviously this isn't the biggest objection people have to this World Cup, but 4 games a day, every day, for what is it, 10 days?
That's brutal.
That's too many matches.
Too much.
13-year-old me would be all over that.
You say that though, but I think normally in a World Cup, there's one day where there are 4 games in a row. And last year it was that first Saturday. And I just think no one has the appetite to watch 4 matches in a row. I think we saw that in lockdown.
Because the match-going fans, James, they can go to all 4 games if they want.
Yeah, but imagine that.
They won't want to, because nobody wants to watch 4 games in a day.
No one.
Doesn't matter where you are.
I literally had this in the last World Cup. I'm going to try and remember what the games were. I think it was France-Australia was the first one. Argentina-Iceland maybe the second one. Peru-Denmark was the third one. I had no appetite for Croatia-Nigeria after that. I was sated. I couldn't watch another World Cup game. It was too much.
It's a simple solution
It's insane.
Just get the FIFA executives to watch like an expanded Super Sunday just once in their life, and they'll realise that they'll be all up for the first game, get a bit bored, fall asleep for at least half of the second game, and not really, and then wake up and wonder how it's still going on. Then finally pluck up the energy to watch the headline third game in a row. Then they'll realise it's difficult to watch 3 games in a row, let alone 4. Right, next up, Gary Shufflebottom writes in, Jack, and says a tournament should start with the defending champions losing the first match. The hosts then win their first game on the second day. Happy with this? You want your World Cup to kick off with a bang, don't you?
Yeah, I think, really good first game is obviously important, but the holders being shit is so important. It's become a really big and, really good thing about the World Cup in the last 20 or so years. I think France losing to Senegal in 2002 is maybe one of the best games in World Cup history, given how good that France team were. But like Italy finishing bottom of an incredibly easy group in 2010 was amazing. Even Spain in 2014 getting hammered by Holland was also amazing. That was also a classic game in its own right. And then of course Germany going out last time. So yeah, all bang up for this time.
Yeah, it's kind of like entry-level Schadenfreude, James. I mean, no one really has the hatred of certain countries at international level at a World Cup like they would do in, say, at club level. But it is just nice to see big countries who won the last tournament just having an absolute mare for all sorts of reasons.
But it is a counterbalance to what you usually see at club level, which is one club dominating or a small group of clubs dominating. So to see the champions fall at the first hurdle,
yeah,
just not a thing you really see in club football often.
Champions. World Cup champions.
Yeah, but they're world champions.
Okay.
Yeah, of course they are.
I would accept world champions, but I wouldn't accept champions on its own. Just...
Well, okay. Fine.
Come on, you know it's right,
Jesus,
don't you?
Christ. No, it's fine.
World champions is better than World Cup champions.
Can I just dial back, though? I just want to take exception with one thing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have the host nation playing on the second day, surely. Now the tradition is the host nation play on the first day.
Well, funny you say that. Producer Dave has made a note in the running order. He's saying hosts opening the tournament is rubbish. And he's right.
I don't disagree with that, especially when the host is someone rubbish like Qatar. You want one of the big hitters playing on that first day, that first game, ideally. The peak, I would say, Brazil v Scotland in 98. Again, 98. Apologies. That's a great first game.
Yeah, it is. Two kits look good together.
France, Senegal, as Jack says, good.
Agreed. Germany, Costa Rica was good.
That was hosted.
It's quite a good game, but it's a bit wishy washy, isn't it?
Good goals.
What was 2010? South Africa. Was it Mexico they played? Was it Mexico?
Yeah, Shabalala.
Bit rubbish.
Interesting. Okay.
Russia thumping Saudi was rubbish.
Brazil, Croatia was good.
Yes.
Croatia was good.
Okay. On a lighter note, James, this is from Alex Everson, who says, Brazil must be in Group D, E, F, or G, with a co-commentator mentioning that the World Cup just hasn't got going until Brazil play.
Yeah, that is definitely true.
I just realised that really is a thing, isn't
it? That is good. Yeah.
It's not really a World Cup until you see those yellow shirts coming out, and oh, it really feels like a World Cup now, doesn't it? Yeah, samba. Atmosphere. Not sure about this one from Jonathan Woodjack. He says, we need a group that goes to the wire with every team finishing on the same points and ideally goal difference, like Group E in 1994. To me, that stinks of a lack of quality.
It doesn't feel like something which we often really see at all, right? Like, I can't... For some reason, I was going to say it sounds like something you get more in Champions League football. There's no reason... I mean, I guess in Champions League you've got twice as many games as in a World Cup group, but that doesn't quite sound right to me.
Finally, on the format point, James, very extended format section this. George Cooper says, you need a perfectly balanced semi-final that lives up to the hype. Think Brazil versus Holland, 98. Oh, yes. Ronaldo versus Bergkamp, 1-1 and penalties. Brian Moore commentating. I mean, it adds fuel to the long-held belief that semi-finals are better than finals.
I would agree with that. And I think you can accept one quite flat semi-final if the other one is incredibly good.
Yeah, I would take that deal.
And it's almost always, I think, I mean, you could look up at from 98 and I might be wrong, but I think the first semi-final would be the good one and the second one would always be like an anti-climax in comparison.
Okay. Right, let's move on to more aesthetic matters. Which of you cares about kits the least?
Me.
Okay. James, I want to put a nice spin on this. I don't want to talk about kits anymore, but I do want to talk about goalkeeper kits. What's the greatest era for World Cup goalkeeper kits?
I mean, it seems an incredibly obvious answer, but surely it's the 90s.
It's Italian 90 specifically.
Specifically Italian 90. Okay.
When they all look blank VHS cassettes.
Okay, I see what you mean, yeah. Okay.
Really, really classy. What about referee kits?
Well, I know your answer to that question. It's Italian 90 again, isn't it?
I mean, that happened to be the one I bought on eBay, but actually if you go to 1994, when there was sort of checkered... attempt.
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, yes. I might, if the Athletic let me, I will rank the World Cup referee kits.
Those 94 referee kits are like Adidas, they're incredibly sort of stock image, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're like kind of cliched referee image. Yeah.
I'm going to take an executive decision. I don't give a shit about mascots. Again, we're not going to do mascots. Good. But speaking of events perfectly tailored for your niche enjoyment, lest we forget, the Football Clichés live tour, which kicked off amid sensational scenes at Earth in Hackney on Tuesday night and continues next week at Manchester's New Century Hall on the 15th of November and Dublin's Liberty Hall Theatre on the 16th of November. London was an absolute riot. Let's make Manchester and Dublin the same. Please join us. Go to myticket.co.uk or just Google Football Clichés live.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Oh, look at that! That is wonderful!
Brought to your ears by The Athletic. This is Football Clichés.
Right, back at our perfect World Cup, and no World Cup is perfect, Jack, without some sort of controversy slash row. What is your textbook controversy slash row?
I think the textbook controversy would be the one at Knysna in South Africa between the French team and Raymond Domenech in 2010. You know, the refusing to get off the bus one, because it's... You've got, like, a big country, you've got well-known famous players. It's all a little bit school trip gone wrong as well.
You've got Patrice Evra throwing his lanyard at Domenech, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that what happened?
I think so.
And they're big old lanyards at World Cups as well. That's going to hurt, especially if you get him with a corner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or the metal bit. So, yeah, that kind of school trip gone wrong vibe makes it that the best for me, though I appreciate there are other good ones.
James, I mean, one of the perhaps more tiresome strands of World Cup controversies is the pre-World Cup bonus row. Do you think behind the glamour of all of it, do you think it's just a right old administrative faff to sort out the bonuses for various countries at World Cups?
It's got to be, hasn't it? Because otherwise, why would you not get it sorted before the tournament? But it's incredible how often you see that. Like, how often it's left running into the... Like, I'm someone who leaves paperwork and all this administrative nonsense to the last minute.
Yeah.
I can only operate that way. But, I, surely people that are running associations of major footballing nations shouldn't be doing that.
Jack, I mean, maybe we're kind of being misled by this. Maybe it isn't kind of like performance-related bonuses. Maybe it's just like, it's basically like, it's like mundane stuff like per diems, like somebody whinging about not having money for their laundry or something like that.
Yeah, well, it just reminds me of when, I think, was it the Ghanaian FA had to fly out $3 million in cash. In 2014 to pay all these disputed
like
bonuses.
A reverse heist movie, like a really shit heist movie, isn't it? We're actually bringing the money to you.
Another classic row is, I think, Spain sacking Lopetegui at the very start of the 2018 World Cup was very funny. I generally don't like club football interfering in tournaments. I think it feels a bit icky to me, but in that case it produced a funny outcome.
But that was genuinely pathetic, the Lopetegui scandal, James. It's like a country just feeling undermined by a club declaring a new manager and saying, well, we can't have this, off you go. It's genuinely pathetic behaviour.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it does feel it did speak for their insecurity, didn't it? I think the Spanish FA. Who's the guy who's been sacked three times before World Cups? There's a manager who's been sacked by three different nations before three different World Cups.
Harry Hodzic?
What his name is. That's it. Yes, Harry Hodzic.
My next section is simply defined as moments. I quite like this from Sam Munnery, James. He says, a World Cup needs to have a notable piece of skill or celebration by one particular player, a Cruyff turn, a Roger Miller celebration, Bebeto's rocking the baby celebration, Quatermoch Blanco double foot jump, or I believe it's known, what is it called, the bunny hop.
Bunny hop, yeah.
Yeah. These things sound, I mean, once you actually say them out loud, they already seem quite tired concepts, but it is important that we have these kind of mystique-adding elements, things you don't see in the rough and tumble of the Premier League, just completely, I'm going to say it, exotic.
Well, you need, if you're watching the World Cup, you need to see stuff you've not seen before. It can't be exactly the same as the Premier League. It needs to be different. And you need those little moments that will get like kids hooked into watching football, right? That's kind of those are the things you remember, right?
I mean, yeah.
You know, again, 98, the bunny hop, I remember seeing that. You want mad shit to happen.
Exactly.
It can't all be like serious. It needs to be fun.
That's right. This is memory building stuff. But Jack, let me list these things again with the years attached. Cruyff turn, 1974. Roger Miller's celebration, 1990. Babetta rocking the baby, 1994. Blanco's bunny hop was 1998, perhaps bleeding into 2002. These are distant memories now. Is the World Cup still capable of producing one-off things like this? Or is just football just utterly homogenised and it's impossible to create?
John Terry like diving along the ground against Slovenia in 2010 to try and head the ball away.
What about,
I think that's the best we've got. Yeah. That's the best
what about James Rodriguez and his massive grasshopper?
Oh, does
that
yeah. count?
It wasn't a conscious thing that he did, but it still happened.
Oh, yeah. Maybe just sort of viral content took over and things yeah. just aren't frozen in time anymore. I mean, imagine the Cruyff turn now. Stop oh, it, yeah. Johan!
Johan Cruyff doing Johan Cruyff things.
Specifically one thing. Yeah, good. Let's choose our match ball as well. It's got to be a tango, right, James?
I'm a tricolour man, actually.
Oh, a bit of colour, splash yeah. of colour. The first World Cup ball with any colour on it, the tricolour.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Everything
That's
before
mad.
It was black and white. Unless you take the brown balls of your 30s and your orange Slazengers of 1966.
Yeah, there's something... I'm going purely on the aesthetic, not on the quote-unquote technology. But I just like that. It's quite simple, but it looks good. It's not over the top. There's no mad shit there. It's sharp.
It's a beautiful ball. And Jack, what's more, the tricolour, I recall, was the first ball that had any semblance of kind of marketing speak alongside it. But it was really kind of surface-level stuff, or quite literally, because it said... it had sort of like a thin layer of responsive foam, the tricolour, and that was it. That was the extent of its technical advancement. That's enough, isn't it? That's just the right amount.
Yeah, that is just the right amount. I don't even know how much... I don't even know the name of the ball for this time or how much marketing stuff...
El Ricola.
...will be coming out. I remember there was a... I bought an official Team Geist T-shirt in 2006 that was associated with the ball because I thought it would be like an alternative thing to just having like the England kits from the tournament, which I also had, obviously. So I did have a Team Geist T-shirt in 2006.
So you supported the ball?
Yeah, I guess in a sense I did. But it was just to do with... I thought it looked cool and I also... Which wasn't quite the case.
So that's 2006 T-shirt... depicting the official match ball of the World Cup. I think
it's a Team Geist and it had like the kind of ball logos on. I don't know if official ball t-shirts are a big thing nowadays, but
classifying that as kind of peripheral World Cup merchandise, if you factor in the fact it's about 12 years ago, I think you could just about get away with wearing it like ironically at, I don't know, Sleater Kinney gig or something like that.
That's the sort of thing that I would do, but I believe it's probably... I think I probably gave it to the British Heart Foundation. So it's no longer in my wardrobe.
Say, what a wonderful charitable act from you. Right, so let's get back into some technical matters. James, who's hosting this World Cup? Who's the solid option to host this dream tournament? Where in the world do you want it?
Yeah, good question. I mean, obviously it's a geographical improbability or impossibility, but it does feel like you want it to be a new country every time. And it should be a quote-unquote proper football nation. I don't think you want there to be too many big stadiums. Like, some games should be played at, like, a 30,000-seater stadium, say. Mm-hmm. You don't want every game at, like, a 60 or 80,000-seater. So I don't know who that is. I don't know if you can whack all that in Google and find out who that's going to be.
Well, I think I might have a suggestion that ticks all of your boxes.
What about Colombia? Somewhere like that would be good. I mean, you know, I know they were supposed to have it. Was it 86 they were supposed to have? That works.
One I think that would tick all of James' boxes is Portugal, which is a football-loving country which has never hosted a World Cup.
Yeah, that is good.
I think the modern World Cup would probably be beyond them, which is why they're often, you know, linked with combined bids with Spain. But they could certainly fit it all in. And
you know what?
The stadiums.
Having been in Lisbon quite recently as well, when I was there, I was thinking how amazing it must have been in Euro 2004 when they had games at the Alvalade and at the Estádio da Luz.
And Phil Collins at the Alvalade, don't forget.
And, yeah, Adam Hurry watching Phil Collins, of course. Mm. I mean, it must have been amazing. What a place
and
to be.
Mike
I forgot
and the
you were there. I hadn't even considered that you were there. It must have been great.
Yeah, it's absolutely
this
brilliant.
This is 100%. We should campaign for this.
Yeah,
this
give Portugal a World Cup. 100%.
Class. Portugal would be amazing.
They've got that stadium with the cliff behind it as well. So you can play all the shitty little games there just for a bit of interest.
This is so good. Euro 2004 was amazing. We've nailed it.
Porto is amazing.
Yeah, this is great.
Guimarães is a good ground.
Public transport's really good. People are all really nice. Yeah. Food is good.
Just to add to the mise-en-scene of this Dream World Cup, Stu writes in and says he wants the advertising hoardings to be only JVC, Fujifilm, Gillette, Coca-Cola. That's it. No Hisense involved. No Herman garage doors either. It's all about the big historical brands that may or may not exist anymore. Right, James, let's touch on TV coverage a little bit, please. If you had to pick one theme tune for whatever channel's coverage for this Dream World Cup, what's it going
to
be?
Well, it has to be a piece of classical music. So I know more pieces of... Because I only know pieces of classical music.
Proper classical, like, or like nouveau classical, like you would hear in The Shawshank Redemption or something?
No, probably proper classical.
Okay.
I would say.
All right.
No one knows Nessun Dorma without Italian Auntie, do they? I mean, that is way more... I mean, this is going to sound so uncultured, but it's obviously way more mainstream because of that.
Sure.
What's the 98... Was it Pavan, is it? The one that was used by S Club 7 later on BBC. Then the one, the ITV 2008 one, the Mozart one, Queen of the Night, I think it is. Like, these are the only bits of classical music I know, and it's because they were theme tunes to major tournaments.
Yeah, I mean...
So what I need is another bit of classical music to be introduced to me in the form of a montage of, like, footballers doing stuff.
I think you're bang on. It's an evocative piece, almost by definition. It's something somebody might not have heard before. It's relatively timeless. Even the youngsters would start to enjoy it. Do we need kind of gimmicky theme music? There was a lot of love, Jack, for ITV's 2014 World Cup. I think the Brazil.
Yeah, that was good.
Which I realise is an historical song, but it was just a bit too jaunty. I want oomph. I want gravitas in my World Cup theme.
Yeah, I think that sounds fair. Who was it who had Arcade Fire? Have I got that completely wrong? Didn't somebody have Rebellion, or was that?
No,
I might be complete. So I'm sure.
ITV had Kasabian in 2006. Certainly not comparing Kasabian to Arcade Fire. But it was terrible. It was a cover of Heroes, wasn't it? I think really bad.
Could debate this all day. I like this from Layman's Gloves though, Jack. He simply says BBC Studio must have a tremendous view, like disgustingly good view, to the point where it looks like they outbid the rest of the entire world to get it.
Ludicrously cliched.
Yeah, France 98 being the classic,
yeah.
But I love that.
But what it actually turns out, James, is they're all in one big media block and they all have the same fucking view.
Well, it's funny you say that because in 2014 in Rio, I saw the media block and it looked shit. It's just like a sort of storage container stacked on top of each other at the end of Copacabana.
Right.
So, like you say, you think they've got this amazing view down the beach, but actually they're just like above ITV and below Canal Plus or whoever.
Okay. Right. A couple of other little broadcasting bits for you. James, I can, well, not exclusively reveal, but I can tell you the pairings for the World Feed commentator. The absolutely legends that traverse World Cups for the benefit of listeners and viewers all around the world. Here are the commentator pairings. Peter Drury and Alan Smith, solid A-list. John Roder and Casey Stoney. David Stowell and Lucy Ward. Daniel Mann and Andy Townsend. That's got the sort of second best game of the day on ITV written all over, isn't it?
Yeah, I can feel the rapport already.
Simon Brotherton and Matt Holland, again, steady. And then, for the real global viewers, Kevin Keatings and Efan Ikoku. Great stuff.
Love that.
The World Feed is essentially the dark horses of the broadcasting World Cup. Genuine legends who know the game, like, in the truest sense. And then you get a sprinkling of people who are sort of aspiring co-commentators who are looking to get into the big time, but looking to cut their teeth on the World Feed. Deserves more of our attention and plaudits, as far as I'm concerned. Jack, love this one from Tom McGuigan. He says, I want one commentator to say that a player plays his football in country X for name of club Y club. And helpfully, he's picked out an example. He says, it's usually said about a player in a club they've never heard of until they saw it on that day's team sheet. Superfluous the and club gently signals the commentator's lack of knowledge. The candidate for this time, Oscar Duarte, who is a Costa Rican who plays for the Al Wehda club in Saudi Arabia. That's a very solid example. But it's a nice little touch, isn't it? I know we talked about this before, but it's a lovely little traditional World Cup touch. Adds a little bit of distance, doesn't it?
It's associated with something that you really want in a World Cup, which is players you've never heard of. You need a solid number of players you've never heard, a solid proportion of players you've never heard of. You don't want them all to be, oh yeah, it's guys from the Champions League clubs. So yeah, more of this, please.
James, simple question for you. The venue for our dream final, do you want it to be a big, expansive, Olympic-style stadium with a completely unnecessary running track, or a genuinely massive like historic club stadium that has a bit more of an intimate feel, but perhaps isn't quite suited to a World Cup stage.
Yeah, I can't think of an example, but I like the idea of like a historic stadium that isn't normally a football stadium. Oh. There's something quite good about that.
Well,
94 presumably was like that.
The whole World Cup, I suppose.
But there's something quite good about like it like football coming, like imposing itself on another sport in the biggest way possible.
I mean, take the Bernabeu, for example, Jack. An incredible stadium. Is it a World Cup final stadium? It's a Champions League final stadium, of course, but is it a World Cup final stadium? No reason why not. Is it too intimate?
I think it might be World Cup. It's got the kind of like openness of a big World Cup final stadium, I think. I think it would, I mean, look, if the Olympiastadion in Berlin could have one, I think the Nou Camp could have one.
Fans too close to the pitch for me.
I think they might be, for some reason, the World Cup final, though, mightn't they?
As in, for a World Cup final, they might just like some of those bottom rows they could always fill with hoardings and FIFA family.
Okay, we've got our dream final venue. We've been through the process, the 32-team process, nice and straightforward. We've got to where we are. All the aesthetics are taken care of. But, Jack, what does the winning goal in the final look like for you in your dream World Cup?
I think we've got a really good example, which is the Iniesta goal.
I thought you were going to say that. Why?
Which is so, it's so satisfying the way that, like, one, because of, you know, the immense pressure of it being extra time and everything, but the way that, goes through Fabregas and they kind of patiently work it over. And you can tell that they're all exhausted. And then it's just a case of, we've just got to get it to the guy over there.
Mm.
And it is, yeah, it just makes it really, really satisfying goal to watch back. And even the way that it bounces. So I'd say something which looks meticulously worked at under extreme pressure and exhaustion.
The one thing I do like about Jack's suggestion, James, is like it's... at the end of that move, Iniesta is a finish, not under great pressure, but he has to nail it. He has to get it right in that moment, which I think is a good thing for a World Cup. Other examples, like sort of real kind of extended one-on-ones. I'm thinking Burruchaga for Argentina against West Germany in 1986, where sort of Maradona releases him and he has to run for ages. And that means all the cameras can have a real good look at him before he slides under the keeper. A good one-on-one's nice.
What I want to see this goal scored by a player who isn't already a certified superstar. Like I want it to be the thing they're going to be remembered for. So like obviously, you know, 98 again, that puts Zidane on the map. 2002, you know, is amazing redemption story for Ronaldo. A great story, amazing. But both of those players would be remembered regardless of those goals. I mean, in recent history, like Mario Götze, maybe.
Yeah.
That kind of profile, a good player, but not like an absolute copper-bottomed legend of the game. You know, and it's kind of also the goal is kind of good, but not great as well. Like you could, like kids can like recreate that in the playground. It's a bit more scrappy. It kind of feel, I don't know, it's something a bit more believable about that.
Okay.
You don't want it to be too Roy the Rovers. That's too obvious.
Very interesting that you say that, because it's just dawned on me. You know how we were talking about how certain club stadiums just don't lend themselves to being World Cup final venues, or it doesn't seem like, but certain goals don't lend themselves to World Cup finals, Jack. What was the last genuine screamer in a World Cup final, decisive or otherwise? I can't think. I'm looking back through finals now. There are some that have kind of passed through my memory and out the other side, but I think you have to go all the way back, and I'm being generous here, to 1970 in Carlos Alberto, and that was more of a kind of narrative screamer. It's obviously a very good move, but I don't know. Obviously, no, it's a fucking great goal, isn't it? But I don't think there's been a better goal than that in 50 years of World Cup finals.
Well, I think, was it Pogba scored one from quite far out in 2018?
That keeper couldn't move.
But it was a weird goal in a weird game. Like, for a start, there were far too many goals in that game to be a proper World Cup final.
Right, interesting.
And it didn't...
It was too mental a final, wasn't it?
With the exception of Perisic, none of the goals actually felt sufficiently big enough. Like, they didn't feel momentous enough.
Yeah,
For me, that Pogba goal doesn't have the kind of, you know, like, historical memory behind it that it might do.
Yeah, it's like a shit-munchy winner of the goal of the month, isn't it, James? It's like, you know, there was no real narrative behind it.
Yeah, I never really considered that before, but that does really prove the point, doesn't it? I don't think you want the World Cup... Like, the World Cup should have loads of great goals, but the World Cup winning goal shouldn't be like that.
Right, final question for you both. Jack, of all the teams that have ever competed in the FIFA World Cup, who's winning this one for you?
A South American team. I think the Euro dominance has ruined the World Cup in the last few years. So all I want from this time, for my perfect World Cup, is continental competition. A European team and a South American team in the final.
Would you take Brazil? Because... can't we just have a Brazil team winning it, like the good old days where nothing was as bad as it is now? Nothing mattered when they won it.
Yeah, I'd take that, happily.
James?
I want the final to be like an amazing functioning team versus a group of superstars.
Okay.
So you can kind of see, like, I mean, in this tournament, maybe it would be like the real tournament. I mean, not our tournament. Could be like Brazil, Argentina, say. Like Argentina team, they're incredibly functional, have Messi in and it all works really well all of a sudden. And Brazil have a load of amazing players.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think the combination of those, like all those Clásicos from 10, 12 years ago, which isn't to say there weren't great players in that Barcelona team, but they were incredibly functional. They had their way of playing. It was incredibly recognisable. Madrid were just chucking amazing players on a team sheet and seeing what happened. That's the best kind of big match, I think, isn't it?
Okay.
The nicely combination put, of those two things.
Nicely put. That seems to me, James, like the early rumblings of World Cup fever to me. So don't rule it out. It seems like you do care. After all, you care about a true, genuine World Cup.
I really do.
Good. Glad to hear it. Thanks to you, James, for steering us through this dream tournament.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to you, Jack Pitbrook.
Thank you.
Thanks for everyone for listening. Enjoy the World Cup if you can. Bring it on.
The Athletic.